Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Tonight I had the pleasure of interviewing bass icon Jeff Berlin, and he tells me how he started with violin growing up on Long Island, and then he went to Berkeley and actually had Pat Metheny as a teacher, and he actually played in Pat's band.
I'm a violinist since age five, and I became a good one. You know, when you're a Jewish kid in Long Island and, you know, New York, and you exhibit a little musical ability, you're either a pianist or a violinist. So I was given both. And then the Beatles came along. I said, that's it. I don't think I'm going to play violin anymore. And Paul McCartney became my first influence. But I admire McCartney. I don't think his bass playing reached under my skin like Jack Bruce's did. And essentially, the violin is tuned like a bass. The violin from low to high, you know, is G, D, A, E. It's tuned in fifths. But a bass from low to high is E, A, D, G, and it's tuned in fourths. So I thought to myself in my, you know, youthful naivete, oh, I'll learn this instrument quickly. I remember thinking it as a kid. Oh, if I'm playing, you know, Beethoven and Mozart and Mendelssohn, what's, you know, how hard to, what's rock and roll? And of course I learned mine. How silly that thought was shortly afterward. But that was it. McCartney, the Beatles. And then when I heard Jack, my life was changed. That was it, especially the live music. Well, I went to Berkeley in 1972. It was still a small school. I had a lot of attention from remarkably musically focused educators. He was the first guy to show me a sharp five on a chord change. I said, what the heck is a sharp five? And that's why I went to Berkeley. Because Berkeley was teaching me the factual and functional pieces of music harmony that I wasn't aware of. You know, violin music wasn't even remotely connected with the breadth of jazz harmony, and I didn't know some of these things. So when we were there, I was some of the first to play Bright Side Light. He called it song number three or something. You know, and then other tunes that appeared on his on his Bright Side's Life record, we were playing in an ensemble. Gary Burton got me in because I was a good bass student, although I didn't know really what was expected of a bass player in jazz at that time. I had to learn. So I've been very fortunate. I went to Berkeley at that time, and I saw the brilliance of improvisation beyond what Jack did. And I became quite dedicated to becoming the best jazz bassist I could become on an electrified instrument.
Boy, we can attest to that. He has become one of the best bass players on the instrument. Now he tells me who his big influences are, and you'd be surprised how Jack Bruce and Cream really influenced him, though Jeff is a jazz bassist.
Well, my first, I would say, jazz bass hero, electric bass hero, without a doubt, was Stanley Clarke. Again, I was never touched with the brilliance or with the vision that a lot of these other guys, Jaco, Pastorius, Stanley Clarke, Pat Metheny, I didn't have that vision because I didn't know what to do. I didn't. I was so heavily versed in the classical genre that when I became an electric bassist, I am not a genius, and I didn't know what to do. I simply knew something needed to be done. So I guess my first influence was Stanley, and then when Jaco came out, I went and took the frets out of my bass for a year or a few months. I did indeed. And then I put them back in. I got another neck. I don't recall the process. But I was quite convinced that playing a fretless was not going to bode well to produce an original sound. And that if the electric fretted bass had a bit of a dry tone and didn't have that wonderful sonority that a fretless has, at the very least, I couldn't think of any one bass player that defined the fretted bass, while I could think of only one person that defined the fretless bass. The sound itself was defined by Jaco, and therefore, in my mind, for me, it made it a hands-off approach. So I went back to frets, and I looked for years to find something different on the instrument. He was something. I mean, poor man, he really ended up badly, and it was due to mental difficulties and stuff. I have a quick thought to share. You know, I told earlier I went to therapy because I was very critical and very off balance in my life, and I needed therapy in order to discover a lot about myself that I wasn't aware of. And I ended up feeling that criticism of other teachers, a combative nature. I mean, this was all symptomatic of an upbringing that I had, and it was late in life when I learned to let go and become a different person. But ironically, it was I and Jocko, and there was a couple of other guys, I can't remember who seemed to pay a price for mental aberrations that we had. Mine wasn't organic, but it was due to upbringing. But we paid career prices for our attitudes, and poor Jocko paid with his life. So I have to say, my situation might be different, but we did share a similar sort of off kind of sort of a common pathology regarding mental situations. My fortunate story is that I worked very hard in order to heal and to find, you know, calm and balance in my life. And I did. I really did.
I feel the pain that Jeff has, because unfortunately, when you have a critical and strict upbringing in your life, it tends to stay in your mind and you feel it as an adult. Now, Jeff told me how he left Berklee College and went to New York City to become a session player.
I had a wonderful summer. The day I left Berklee, I went to New York, got in a band with Carmine Appice. Then I went to Switzerland to record a record with Patrick Moraes, who was with Yes at the time. And then when I got back, I did a national tour with guitarist Pat Martino. So this was right after music school. And then when I settled in New York, I became a session musician. I did jingles. I did records. It was one of the fertile times in New York music history. Tons of jazz, a lot of R&B, lots of recording. The greatest musicians were there to help me grow as a player, and I was in the thick of it, and I don't think I would have ended up the musician that I feel that I ended up, in part, if it wasn't for those days as a guy just sort of, you know, schlepping from studio to studio and reading and practicing and gigging and jamming. And oh my goodness, I was very fortunate that the universe set up energy for me to be in that environment. One of the things that I like and or encourage young bassists to do is read, because not only is it, let's say, usable for work, in certain capacities you get work by simply being able to read the dots. At the same time, reading develops technique and it gets us to play better. So if it wasn't for my reading ability, and that goes for everybody in New York at that time, we wouldn't walk in, you know, and go, you know, Campbell's soup is the best soup in the world, you know, and then leave. Do you remember, let me see, what was this? Kmart is your shopping place, Bob? I don't know if that's it. I'm the bass player on that. Now, you got to realize, and this is a funny story. I did Kmart is your shopping place, Bob, 1, 2, 3, 4, da, 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 2 bars of bass. And over the next year or two, I earned about $14,000 in royalty money. You remember that? Oh, boy, oh, boy. And then you go out and play at night, and you go to bed, and then you get up the next day, and what was it, Radio Registry? Hey, Jeff, you got a thing at 12, you got a thing at 3, you got a thing at 4. Go and do it. Go, you know, home. Okay, one at 11, one at 10. Oh, my goodness, man. What a wonderful period.
Yes, what a wonderful period in New York City. I grew up in New York City right at that time, and I was a teenager, and it was just overflowing with great jazz music, and I even worked at a jingle house. Now Jeff tells me how he played guitar with Jack Bruce, and a great Jocko story.
Yes, in fact, you're going to laugh here. I was his guitarist for a couple of gigs. He played bass. Bruce Gary, the drummer from The Knack, played drums, and I played guitar. We did a couple of L.A. hits. Sometimes someone writes and goes, I remember when you played at this club or something. But you see, being with Jack is like being with a god. I mean, how do I explain this? I admire musicians, but I am often in awe of their talent. But Jack was the only musician in my life that shook me. Can't explain why, but being around him, it was never as easy to go, "Hi, Jack. Oh, how great to see you." It was like, "Hi, hi, hi, Jackie Gleason." You know, he knew it too. I did a gig in Germany once, and he came to it, and he knew the son of a gun. He knew that he shook me up. So he sat in the front row and I started to mess up. And then the more I'm messing up, he started making faces and put his pinkies in his cheeks and pulled his mouth apart and crossed his eyes. And, you know, every time I messed up, and I'm laughing, and, you know, I had finally got it together, but he knew that he could affect me like that. And he always tried to, this son of a gun. See, that's the thing about the Jack songs. The music's in my mind. It's there. It wasn't difficult to arrange it. It was all there. I listened, as a lot of us young guys, you must have done this. You listen to a record till you wore it out. And that's what I did with him. So that's why I played guitar, because I knew all the music in my head and I'm pretty quick, you know, bah, 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 okay, ready, go ahead, start, let's play. And we did a lot of stuff from songs for Taylor, Harmony Row, Out of the Storm. We did songs from those records. Man, I played guitar for Jack Bruce. Imagine that. Woo! How cool is that? I got a story about Jocko. He appeared at MI. We played a duet together, and afterwards we hung out and chatted, and he said to me, he was sitting outside, and he looked very depressed, and he said, well, I guess my time is over. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, I have nothing new to do. And I didn't say anything there, but I thought about it, and I had a conclusion that often innovators don't have to be like Miles. They don't have to innovate music four times. You know, that often the great creators could have done it once. And if they are in this exclusive club of innovative musicians, they ought to be entitled to a career for the rest of their lives based upon their unique creation earlier on in their life. Jeff Beck is a brilliant guitarist to this day, somebody I want to play with. Never played with him, and I'm not sure it'll ever happen. But, what, you know, I'm spreading the word through the radio and everywhere else that if a change in bass comes along, I want to come and audition. And the reason I mentioned Jeff is because Jeff has achieved a great height in his playing and fairly well stayed in this high echelon. A lot of musicians haven't innovated 3, 4, 5 times, and I think Jocko was wrong to feel that he couldn't have continued doing his Jaco Pastorius thing, since he was still one of the world's premier composers in music, in popular music, and so he could have written parts that would have been innovative. I mean, he did it for most of his bass solos in the Weather Report records. Those are all composed. So, I mean, he could have continued that way. Anyways, and I'm just sharing a thought here, you know, that you don't have to innovate. So I'm letting this message out because Jack really didn't need to. When you're a creator like Jack was, because nobody was like him, he really, I feel, is given that badge to be a member of the greatest of all time club, because he did something that none of us ever did at that time.
Yes, unfortunately, Jocko was a tragic figure, and plus he suffered from mental illness that I believe wasn't treated correctly at the time. Now Jeff goes on to tell me how big of an influence Jack Bruce was on his playing and his new tribute album.
Jack was a hero to me, is a hero to me. He was the first bassist I heard as a young kid. I was 14 when I knew that what he had pioneered was going to be what I wished to emulate in some regard. I think my whole path as a bass player, certainly as a leader, if not, you know, it's separated from being a sideman, was propagated on, pretty much on the things that he had had pioneered. So when he passed away, it was a very hurtful thing to me. I was very hurt by that. And I thought, I knew his music so intimately, you know, post-Cream, a lot of his solo records and Cream. So I thought, I've got to do a record. I always planned to anyway. It was always in my mind. And I wanted to do a record that celebrated his vast catalog of music as much as I could do. And that's what I did. It was a long time work. A long time in recording, a long time in assembling, and but I feel it's my best record. I don't think I've ever done anything as good as a leader as Jack Songs has turned out.
Now, Jeff Berlin's new album is called Jack Songs, and it contains that spirit that Jack Bruce gave to his fans and through his music. And this was quite an undertaking for Jeff, and he explains all the arranging for the album.
These are his songs, but I arranged them differently in that I'm sure you and everybody else is familiar with Sunshine of Your Love. And if you are, people know that that song has been played pretty much identically in just about every rendition that has ever been done of Sunshine. So they're covers, but not in the way one thinks. I arranged every song to be a kind of a menage of different songs, in that each song became a work. Jack's influence on me and his solo music reaches far beyond Cream. Cream was the fortunate trio that he was a part of that showed the world what a great musician he is. But he did marvelous work after Cream. And I was so familiar with the music that I thought, how do you cover a man's career on a CD? So I found a way, and it came from pretty much from an inspiration that I got from, I hope I'm saying his name right, Giles Martin. The son of George Martin, and he did a record called Beatles Love for Cirque du Soleil. And the very first tune, as I recall, it's been a while now, was a kind of a combination of four or five well-known Beatle melodies, and they were all in the same key, and they were all in time. And I thought that was one of the most brilliant jobs of production I'd ever heard, and stayed with me, the impact of Giles's production skills. And so when I did Jack, I did the same thing, except that I didn't take actual quotes off of records or off of recording tapes, but I wrote it out so that, for example, Cream would include five different Jack Bruce references, all that originated during his time with Cream. And then each track subsequently were combinations of various Jack Bruce melodies and harmonies that people are familiar with, but I did them as unique arrangements so that each song would be an epic. I honestly have to say, I don't think they make records like this record anymore. And it was my best work. I forgive me for touting the project. We all love to, all us musicians, you know, we love, oh, you should hear it, but this is honestly my best work.
Yes, it's true. We love to tout our work, but I do understand all of the work and the hard sweat that is put into these kind of productions, because I've done so many of them with famous guitarists. He also has great players on this album, like Bumblefoot, Geddy Lee, and Alex Lifeson.
This is a record that I plan to never review again in my career. I'm exhausted. I've said it before. I'm plumb tuckered out from having done it, although I'm glad I did it. It took a long, long, long time. I financed it. It was a project of love. And how I managed to make it work with all of the guys that I have on the record was, you know, would you do it? And these guys were very forthcoming. They're all fans of Jack's. Geddy Lee and I are both mentioned by Jack as, you know, among his favorite bassists to listen to when Jack was touting his favorite guys and supporting us. Sammy Hagar and I sort of met years ago, and he appeared on a song called L'Angelo Misterioso, which actually was the name for George Harrison when he appeared on a Jack Bruce song that contractually George Harrison wasn't allowed to. But the name, and any Cream fan, any Jack fan, and George Harrison fan will know what L'Angelo Misterioso, the mysterious angel. So Sammy did it on L'Angelo Misterioso. Scott Henderson played solo on it. I had Eric Johnson play guitar on one song. I had Alex Lifeson from Rush. I had Geddy Lee from Rush. They both appeared on the record in two different places. I'm kind of in a fortunate situation. I might be the only guy thus far, you know, well, he has to be this way because of the loss of my friend Neil Peart. But I've had every Rush member as a guest on my records at some time. And they've done me the honor, because these guys are like me. Besides playing, they're fans of different players that they recognize their musical authenticity or whatever it is that they admire. So Alex, as a friend, appeared. Geddy, as a friend, appeared. Lots of guys appeared as friends and as admirers of Jack. I have a great guest list. You're absolutely right about that. It was the greatest assembly job that I could ever imagine. And quite frankly, it was entirely due to the production ability of John McCracken. I had the ideas. He produced the ideas and assembled them so that each song came out seamlessly. It could never have been done without him. But it took many, 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 many months. A lot of dollars and a lot of musicians flying in parts, assembling them. It could have ended up being a horror, but it ended up being maybe my greatest musical creation, because I did write a lot of music for it and assembled it within the arrangements. But John McCracken is the hero of the day. He's the guy that actually made every song sound seamless. You're right. It is like a nightmare, but it's kind of the nightmare one undertakes if one has musical vision, which you clearly do, that when somebody orchestrates a menage of players and tries to make it into a cohesive project, it's a nightmare of assembly. But if it's assembled well, one has little to do but stand at the top of a tower and cheer. I mean, I'm very fortunate I had Eric Johnson on it too, like you, and I had Bumblefoot on it. He was very kind and offered his services. Oh, Ron is a wonderful, and what a player. I mean, maybe one of the finest there is as a guitar player. So I'm very fortunate. It all worked out well, although I'd like to take a Tahiti vacation to recover, because it was murder, man. Assembling over 100 and something tracks, and we flew drums in for the Cream Jam. There's only one Cream Jam on the record, which was Scott Henderson, Gary Husband, and me, and we did it in the middle of L'Angelo Misterioso, and it's smashing, but we had to gel the drums to sound acoustic flowing from one to the other. We did a lot of firsts on this record, first for us. So yeah, man, I'm beat. I'm coming over for dinner. Let your family know. May I raise a thought? Okay. When Sammy Hagar came on to sing, one of the things that I admired mostly about his contribution wasn't the mere, let's say, the mere fact that he's, quite frankly, exactly the kind of singer I wanted. But you see, a guy of his stature, a guy of his name and impact and established reputation in music, didn't have to accept a kind of a nickel and dime gig like mine, you see? And what I admired about him, that it didn't happen with other musicians that I called. I don't want to say anything because I respect people. If they don't wish to do it, they don't. But I went right to the A-list. And the A-list was basically about as high as one could think. And I went fairly well to the top players who I felt were also good players, not just for their names, but great singers, great players. And basically everybody turned me down, which I understand because, you know, I'm just the guy. I mean, I'm just a musician. But I had a thought after he was enthusiastic about it. What Sammy represented to me was a guy that after decades of doing his thing, there was really nothing left to the A-list musicians that could be that special to them, except perhaps to participate in a project that might be so musically stimulating that they wouldn't have thought of it without the help of the guy that called them to play. So what I'm saying is that if I were in the status of these guys and you called me and I knew you were a reliable and great musician and that you had a track record, count me in, because I would think, wow, what a new musical adventure I'm about to have. And I'm not sure that the other guys thought that way, but they get 20, you know, 30, 50 requests a day. But I'm an established guy. I'm known for my musical ability. A lot of guys are, so I hope I'm not sounding egotistical here. But Sammy was the only guy except for the bass friends like Eddie Lee and Alex Lifeson. They did it too because they loved Jack. But most of these other guys said no. And I thought, it's a shame because they lost maybe a moment of something really artistically and musically different. And that's why, one reason, forgive me if I'm wandering here, but that's one reason why I'm grateful to Sammy, because he had that vision.
I totally understand where he's coming from, because I've had the same experience where some people just don't hear it or just don't get it. And it's wonderful that Sammy Hagar's on the record as well. Now he tells me how he's going to tour this album probably next year and how he's going to go about doing it.
Well, we are. I was going to tour in 2023. And I have a band assembled, but interestingly, the agents with whom I work suggested that I wait one more year and put together a superstar band. In that, if I could get the bigger name people who might be available and want to play Jack's music. So I'm going to wait a year, but next year I'm doing my thing, a jazz trio, or I'm going to tour playing songs that I've written and demonstrate, play, express different ways that I play bass that I didn't demonstrate on Jack's songs, but that I do when I play jazz. So yes, I am. That's for a long answer. I'm going to tour it, but I'm not going to tour it for about a year and a half. I mean, this has a shelf life. I mean, I could tour this for 2, 3, 4 years until. So I'd like to do it right. I really do. I'd love to tour with the band that I have, but we're in a kind of in a situation where names count for booking purposes. I get it. Business is business, and bookers and people want to make money. So I get it. But I'm sort of pushing for this group because it's simply an outstanding playing outfit. So, but we'll see. We'll see. If we get capable people that might see the merits, the musical merits, and possibly the business merits of an assembled ensemble playing the music of one of the greatest superstars of bass that ever lived, it could be a phenomenal event. But I've already contacted a few guys, and it's a harder thing to do than one might think.
Yeah, I can only imagine how difficult this must be to orchestrate a tour, because I know how difficult it is to get everybody in the studio together to be able to do a project like this. Now he tells me about how he still endorses Court and Larry Coryell.
Yeah, I mean, it's about a decade or more that I've been playing the same bass and using the same amps. In fact, I recorded the entire Jack Bruce record, the Jack songs, only on one amp, and it's arguably the cheapest amp in their amp list. It's called a Player's School. It's a 15-inch speaker, and I've been using that, or they made me my own model amp, you know, my own amp, and it was called, coincidentally, Jeff Berlin. I said, what a coincidence. I had the same name. It's, like, amazed me. So I would tour with that amp if I did gigs. But now I'm going to the Player's School amp because I use two of them, and I'd like to use it with stereo, you know, with chorus and with a couple of effects. The tone is brilliant, and the bass I use is a Court. And people say, why don't you use something else? But the Court gave me a tone that I can't find anywhere else, and the bass is a rhythmic. It's simply the finest bass, and I'm very loyal to companies. I don't hop around and, oh, you offer me more money? I'll go with you. We used to do it in the old days. I won't name a couple of guys, but you'd see ads in Downbeat or Guitar Player or Bass Player, and that's it. Every 3 months, so-and-so showed up saying, well, this is my new bass. And I tend to be very loyal, especially because I love the tone from the gear that I get from Mark Bass and from Court. So I'm staying with them, probably till the end. Not probably, till the end, if they'll have me. I played quite a bit with Larry. We were very good friends. And I'm friendly with his widow, Tracy, sure. And Larry introduced me to Court because at the NAMM show, he would go to they would have these dinners, you know, after the, you know, in the evening. And so, Jeff, you want to come to dinner? I'll introduce you to Court. So I used to go with him. And we had a great, great time. I mean, so I met Court, and I used to hang out with Jack Westheimer, who actually, I think, owned Court in America. His sister was Ruth Westheimer, the sexologist, Dr. Ruth Westheimer. And he is an interesting fellow, and we would hang out. And every year, Danny Gottlieb and I would go to dinner with him. You know, the three Jewish guys would get together, and we'd go, ah, you're telling me? No, I ain't going. You're going to go? Ah, don't ask. I'm not going. And we just... And it's funny, when you get Jewish guys together, they usually get more Jewish. So how are you? Dennis, you don't want to know how I'm doing, you know. So Jack and Danny would hang out at this place and at this wonderful restaurant that we went to every year until Jack passed away. And coincidentally, then I got friendly with John Park, who was the Korean, the brother of in the Korean company of June Park. And it was June that I met, and it was June that got me this ridiculously amazing bass, a passive bass. I think it's as good or better even than the 62 jazz bass. I really do. Well, only because the tone and the components are modern. I agree the older instruments are artistically and historically way more attractive to people. But the bass tone, in that the components are more modern, and the bridge, the Babbage's bridge, and just the instrument, to my thinking, the rhythmic is equal, maybe better built. And it's astonishing. That I'm just looking at it from a practical bass playing point of view.
See, it just goes to show you don't need the most expensive bass or guitar or amp to sound terrific. It's all in the hands. As we all remember, he was a teacher in Guitar Player magazine, and he explains how he continues to teach students through the new decades.
On and off, because we're in a time where people want to study with me, sign up to study with me. I give them a lesson, which is based in sort of the same aspect of the character of learning that Charlie Benakis used to give me, which is musical content. I assign this to bass players at their level. I don't give them, transcribed symphony number, whatever. I'll say, take these lines and play them in these keys, and then get back to me. And practically, to a man, practically to a woman, no one ever does. We're in a time now where a little bit of enabling is going on, I feel, in bass education, where it's the seeking of and making people comfortable with their lessons. Whereas my vision is that it can't be that uncomfortable to take music at one's level, take their instrument and work on it. It's not as awful as I feel some people feel that it is, but it's a common belief because there's a lot of emphasis on fun in bass education. You really ought to have fun. And I'll disagree in the sense that learning isn't fun, and it isn't awful, and it isn't ecstatic, and it isn't terrific. It's a means to play our instrument better and grow in music, and that's all that it is. And it shouldn't be 10 hours a day, but a 30 minutes to an hour for new players that's tolerable while they then go and jam and do everything else. But when I give music to people, they're so thrown by it that they don't come back because people want fun. It's a new phenomenon. But music throws people. I'm very patient with it. I have a rep as a hard guy, but I'm not. I learned not to criticize teachers, and I won't. I do respect teachers that teach differently than me. I respect students that wish to be taught differently than I do. But at the same time, I do believe that there is a kind of a slight agreement among teachers and students not to make a student either feel challenged by practice when practicing is entirely based upon the challenge of working on the music, and teachers kind of enable, whatever you want, that's okay, or what do you want, or that's cool, or there's lots of ways to learn. So I'll respect the opinions, but tend to see this generation as possibly the most challenged in the history of my instrument, because even in the 50s, when guys were self-taught, guys, let's say bass players for Fats Domino or Little Richard or Elvis or all those guys, almost all of them are self-taught. But today, playing is sort of compromised to where a lot of guys have many basses but don't know how to tune them by ear and don't know how to play. So when a big mouth like me comes along and says, listen, guys, I don't think you're getting the best advice, and you ought to separate practicing from actually gigging or playing, nobody else says this, and it kind of throws people. But I have to live with this, that I'm sort of an outlier and a guy that isn't really quite in step with the times. I believe in music, and I know I can improve anybody, but people have to meet me halfway, and I'm not sure they will. Well, that's interesting you say that, because I'm mostly interested in beginner students than advanced guys. I really don't have much of a dedication to the advanced guys or upper intermediate guys, because they know what to do to learn. It's usually the beginners and possibly people under influence of popular philosophy of learning that might not have heard anything that I generally say about the value of learning music itself. And it just throws people. And so I generally am far more interested in the beginner bassist, the new bassist, because I know I can get them on the right track and not make them physically ill with the idea that, oh my goodness, I've got to slow down and turn my metronome off and learn these notes, because that's a temporary apprenticeship. 2-3 months and that time is over. But there's guys that are 20, 30 years that still haven't gotten better. And it's always the older guys that write me. Always. I should have listened to you when I was younger. And then these guys say, I want to take a lesson. So I say, sure, okay, now take this and practice these notes and everything. Oh, great. Thank you very much. You know, and they don't call back. Can I share a thought? You know, have you ever heard the name Charlie Benakis? Charlie taught some of the most dedicated musicians in music history when we were kids. Well, I mean, young 20s. Mike Stern, he studied with him. I studied with him. I'm thinking of a million guys. I can't think now. And he would give us homework every single week. Hey, man, here, take this thing. I want you to play this in 12 keys, man. And I want you to check out this, how this works this way. So I don't want you to do this. I want you to do that. Okay, great. You practice it. Hey, Charlie, all finished. And here's my tape, because he did it with cassettes. And this is what I did. That was 7-8 days later, an envelope would show up. Hey, man, now I want you to do it this way. And Charlie assigned us lessons every week for months and months and months, because we were more in love with knowing how to play and in love with the idea of doing what we needed to do in order to become better players. See, I did that work, and I don't have to worry about it. I didn't have to worry about it for 40 years. I mean, I could certainly play better from my artistic vision, but guys that took the time early and learned music never, ever had to sweat it out later in their lives. Just never. And unfortunately, that's not a popular concept, so I love to share it, that the young guys that love music more than anything, there's a way to go about it. I'm not sure there's too many other ways to regard, but people have to consider that, and that way is to sit down with the music, practice it, and then stop. Go jam, go rock out, do whatever you want. But tomorrow, open that music again for 30 minutes. And if people do that for 3 to 4 or 5 months, they'll never recognize themselves. I don't know either, but listen to you. You're absolutely right. You see, you gotta want it. And if people don't want it, I'm not sure why even the expenditure of money or time to go to teachers is in the plan, because you go to teachers to elevate your playing. That's why I think we all do. I would go to a teacher to elevate my playing, and that I feel needs regard. If people honestly decide not to improve, which some have because I read their posts, and it's their right. I respect that. But anybody else that wants to, there's a couple of things one has to do, and I promise people you won't get hurt by them. I think music scares the bejesus out of people, when really all you got to do is learn a few notes to start with.
Jeff's absolutely right. Now, come on, you guys. Learn a few notes to start with. You'll be really happy you did. Now, here's a great medley from Jeff Berlin's new album, Jack Songs. And it takes you back to those days. It's called Creamed. Thank you.
just show you. Sleepy time, time, all the time.
We'll be right back.